Hi, welcome to the Spotlight Report. I'm your host, Logan Graves. This is a monthly podcast where we dive into topics that pique our interest. They typically cover optics and science, but honestly, they can be quite broad. You can find out more about the Spotlight Report and find all of our episodes, as well as comment or like the podcast, on our new location, which is on the ELE Optics Community Forum. That location is community.eleoptics.com, and you'll find the Spotlight Report there. You can also now help to contribute to support the Spotlight Report by following the link below in the show notes.
So I'm sorry, Ms. Klein, is this a Spotlight Report?
Sure, let's
okay.
Go.
Okay.
So this is something that I don't typically do for an episode, to record an intro before the episode segment, but I went into this interview somewhat uniquely. I didn't know David. I reached out and he very generously offered to share his time to speak with me. And before the episode happened, David asked me a question. He asked specifically how a magic trick works, an illusion, actually, if you're Joe Bluth. He asked me how a magician is able to make it look as though somebody is levitating in midair and they'll pass a hoop around the person. This is a magic trick I'm sure most everybody has seen, but he said, think about it. See what you come up with. And I would encourage my listeners to take the time before you look it up. Try to think about how it's performed. There's no, trickery involved. There's no hidden effects after the fact where things are edited out in a picture or video. And it was interesting going into it because it set the tone. After speaking with David, I had a similar experience as I did with this magic trick. That is, going into the conversation, I had looked at David's optical designs that he had posted in the past, and when I looked at them originally, they were nothing short of magic, frankly speaking. They're absolutely incredible designs, and from my perspective, I had no idea how someone would actually arrive at these designs. After speaking with him, I felt like I had a better idea of how someone actually does this. It's not magic. There's no tricks involved. There's an actual design philosophy. And it felt like the veil had been pulled back, so to speak. So I really hope that my listeners or the listeners of this podcast get the same experience as I did. It's something unique that I don't often experience in optics. And I want to encourage everyone as well who's listening to please follow the links. They're always worthwhile, but I would say especially so. David Schaefer, over his years of experience, has incredibly generously produced free slides discussing his designs and his approaches to optics and philosophy and art. And frankly speaking, they're almost invaluable resources. So I strongly, strongly encourage anyone listening, please follow them. Please take the time to look through them. They're entertaining and incredibly informational. And with all that being said, I hope that you enjoyed the episode today. I know that I did. Well, this week on the Spotlight Report, I am very excited to be speaking with David Schaefer. He has an extensive background in optical design and also philosophy, actually. So, David, thanks so much for taking the time to talk today. When you had first messaged me, I told you usually I ask people how they got into optics, and apparently you got into it as a baby. Do you mind kind of talking about what that process was?
Yes, I got into being fascinated by light very early because my parents told me that as a baby, if I cried a lot, they would put me underneath a bare light bulb. And I became fascinated with this light above me. And ever since, like when I go outside, I look at the sun and I'm sort of drawn to overhead lights. Which reminds me, I don't know if you've heard this before, but it's an old riddle, which is more useful to us, the sun or the moon? And the answer is the moon, because the moon only shines at night when it's dark, whereas the sun shines in the daytime when it's light anyways.
I like that. Well, that had to have made it convenient for your parents as well, in so far as baby toys go. So beyond that, I mean, how did you formally enter into the study of optics?
Well, a little older than the baby. When I first saw a magnifying glass, I was really amazed at it and just fascinated with this curved glass that you could see through it. So there's nothing hidden inside the lens that's making this happen. How is that possible? So I was very interested in lenses up until the time when I made my first telescope when I was 13, and I made a 6-inch mirror using a kit from Edmund Scientific became interested in astronomy, but basically it was always the optics that most interested me.
Is this the is Edmund Scientific the same as the current Edmund Optics? Okay.
Yes.
Okay. When I was a kid, my father had a, I don't know, 6-inch large magnifying glass that similarly, I had kind of forgotten about this. I would love to take outside and go set leaves on fire and things like that with it. So
yeah.
So beyond that, it looks like you moved on and studied, I believe, at University of Rochester. Is that correct?
Right. Yes.
And Kinglake taught the design course there.
Yes. At that time in 1961, when I went there, there were only two places in the Western Hemisphere where you could get an undergraduate degree in optics. One was the University of Arizona and the other was Rochester.
Mm-hmm.
I lived in New York State and I got a Bausch and Lomb scholarship to Rochester. So that was a no-brainer.
Right,
and,
right.
Kinglake only taught that course to grad students, mainly because if you got exposed to him as an undergraduate, you probably never want to go into optics. He's a very boring person, very old school, Victorian age type of person.
Huh.
So, yeah.
And this is the same Kinglake that had written one of the key optical design books, right? That
yes, it's sure actually most... it was two volumes. And when I was 15, I went to the Cornell bookstore, not expecting to find it there, but I just happened to see the two volumes of Kinglake's book, and I bought those. So in high school, I tried some ray tracing by hand using six-place logarithms, which is how people did it before computers, because there were no computers. And after you've traced a couple rays through a doublet, you decide you never want to do that again. But right around that time, computers were starting to... And when I went to University of Rochester in 1961, they had a mainframe, the old type where it actually had circuit boards you could pull out and it had all these transistors and stuff soldered into place. This is way before, you know, modern ideas about what a computer could be. But the students in optics were given a certain amount of time on the computer. And Kinglake's course had a lab aspect, which consisted of doing some actual lens design exercises with punch cards using that computer. So I was very fortunate that that allowed me to not have to do any hand tracing at all. And it's a mind-boggling to think what used to happen. And during World War II, there was a lot of hand ray tracing of bomb sites and other optical systems. And the teams that would do it were all women because they found that women are more accurate in not making mistakes and stuff. In fact, they actually had two teams, both doing tracing the same system, and they would compare the results and see if they agreed as a way of spotting errors.
Right, right. I mean, you know, for coming from my exposure to optics, what you're describing is so different. It's very fascinating. But one of the things that popped out to me that you said as well, just to take even a further step back, I mean, at 15, you're actively seeking out optical design books.
Of which there were almost none, by the way.
Of which there are almost none. So it's an even bigger hurdle than it is today. Just to put this into context, was optics at that time well known, because it, at least a lot of the people that I've spoken to who have gone through undergraduate programs in the last 10, 15 years, they didn't really get an idea of the word optics until they were in college, basically.
No, the experience of the making a telescope exposed me to the idea of, then I read up on it. And much later in life, I realized one of the attractions, actually it was two attractions of optics for me as a young person. One of them is I was somewhat nearsighted, but did not know that. I didn't know about such thing. And I found that any optical system, microscopes tell you could focus it. So I would focus it to be the sharpest thing. And that was unconsciously, I was thinking, this is a really cool image compared to, you know, the nearsighted view. It was a small effect.
Right, right.
The main effect, though, was I found, and again, I only realized this later, that with a telescope or a microscope, you can observe things as if you were very close to them without actually being close to them. And I was a shy boy growing up in the on a farm with almost no friends or exposure to people. Mm-hmm. That's the farm life. And here was a way of sort of pretending that I was close to things,
right,
not the risk of actually having to be there and exposing myself to the risk of interpersonal relationships, which I'm starting to work on right now.
Right. Well, I think that's a very almost romantic or unique view of optics, which I really appreciate. And I think it brings us nicely into the other aspect of your career that at least I find fascinating. I can't speak for how many of the listeners will, but you also studied not only optics, but philosophy. At least to most people, that might seem like an unusual combination. So why philosophy as well?
Well, again, when I was 13 and making the telescope, and you look up in the sky and you see these incredibly, you know, distant stars and the number of them, and just imagining the scale of the universe. And very early in life, I started to wonder, what's it all about? And, you know, why are we here instead of over there? That kind of thing. And the thing that most appealed to me about philosophy, which also appealed to me about lens design, it's basically an exercise in pure thought. You don't need lab equipment. You don't need anything to just think about something and maybe make progress. And I think that's a very exciting idea that, you know, you can achieve a lot in at least in theory, mm-hmm. by such simple means.
And riffing off of that, pure thought seems to be a core component of that idea. And I certainly agree. And maybe we can touch on this in a bit, that there's an upside and a downside to too much pure thought, perhaps in optical design. But that desire for kind of strictly theoretical models or mental models, I suppose, is a better way to phrase it, dissuaded you a little bit, I think, from electrical engineering. It was a little too not up your alley, let's say that. Is that accurate?
Yes, it is. And I was thinking that I noticed very early that there's an elegance to lens design, in that if you see a cross section of a camera lens, say, there's nothing concealed. There's no hidden mechanisms. The light rays go through sequentially, which is much simpler an idea than, say, electrical feedback loops. There's a company in Tucson, in Arizona, where they wrote a little program where if you just give it a picture of a patent design or any picture of a lens cross section, the program curve fits sort of extracts what the prescription is likely to be. And it's going to be very close to the, and then they can put it into an optimization program and, you know, reverse engineered
right
design. So a picture conveys everything. And mm-hmm. people who are not lens designers don't know that. So like a project manager who's not a technical guy might think, well, it doesn't matter if you show a picture of your proprietary design because there's no numbers.
Mm-hmm.
But so what? So
right,
I love the elegance, you might say, of the simplicity of optics, the sequential aspect, that kind of thing. And also I was saved, one last thought, was by not being coming of age when computers existed, I wasn't seduced into all the things you can do with a computer. So to me, that was a fortunate accident.
Right. No, I can't agree strongly enough. And we'll definitely get to that component of your kind of philosophy of design for optics in a bit. But I just wanted to say, from what you're describing as well, that visual aspect of optical systems and the elegance of it, it's one of the rare sciences and design processes and fundamentally engineering as well that I know of where you can see a picture and you know. That's a good design, especially some of the multi-element lithographic systems or things like that. When you see kind of the rays very smoothly bending through this, you say, that's a good system. And when you see only a few and it's really sharp bends, probably not.
Right.
definitely a unique aspect of it. So you graduated with a degree in philosophy and in optics, or just philosophy?
Just philosophy. I mean, I was an optics major until my senior year, and that's when they told me I had to take double E to graduate. And I said, I'm not going to do that. And it turned out the grad school at Rochester in optics did not require that.
Okay.
So I immediately went into the grad school in optics, but I got the undergraduate in philosophy.
Right, right. Well, I'm missing that undergraduate in optics obviously harmed your optical career, right?
Yeah.
So you studied optics in graduate school at U of R, and was it still an emphasis on optical design specifically, or?
They only had that one course in it.
Okay.
And I was recently married, and I found that being married and grad school weren't really working out that well. So after 1 year, I dropped out of the master's program.
Went
to work. And I'd worked 2 summers at a super high-tech company in Boston before graduating from my undergraduate. And I went to work immediately for them. And during the Vietnam War, these tech companies were desperate for people with any background in optics. So they were offering big salaries to people at U of R undergraduates. Quit college. Come to us. We'll make it worth your while.
Right. Well, and I mean, people with optics backgrounds must have been even more of a unique phenomenon at that time as well. But we're not, yeah. I like to say there's dozens of us today.
As an undergraduate, there were 5 people that were graduate majors. I mean, optics majors, just 5.
Right. Wow.
As undergraduate.
Right.
And graduate probably weren't so many more.
It's astonishing. How small of a field it is, but how large of impacts it tends to have. So you got a lot of exposure to things that you can't talk about, but I think it's probably fair to say we're cutting edge at the time.
Yes.
Is that accurate assessment? Okay. You finished up that work. What was your takeaway with respect to optics? In the sense of, did the job or jobs shape kind of your perspective towards what you wanted to do in optics, or how you approached optical design, or did you just kind of finish the jobs and say, okay, I'm done with this and it's on to the next thing?
No, what I mainly learned from my jobs is things I didn't want to do, which is get too close to the real world. Mm-hmm. I was sort of conceptually oriented from very early age, and so like lasers were really hot when I was an undergraduate, and I did a little lab stuff with a summer job there. But the whole idea of real things did not particularly interest me. And as a kid, I was very involved in, this is an example of what I call conceptual fishing. I was very interested in fishing. I subscribed to Field and Stream and I read fishing magazines. I got a fishing pole. I spent a lot of time thinking about which lures to buy, a lot of that stuff. And I maybe went fishing twice or so once right. I caught a fish, but that didn't matter. The fun part was the purely conceptual. And the same has been true of optics. It never really particularly interested me whether my designs got built. So going into actually the work experience, you know, it was a lot of fun. It was challenging design problems, but I was never interested in what happened to my designs afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it's interesting because I've seen this kind of distinction amongst people in optics that optical designers, maybe not to the same extent you're describing, but optical designers do typically say, I'm designing a thing, and ideally a perfect thing, really. And people like myself, so my background's more in optical metrology and optomechanics. We look at these perfect designs and say, how are we going to make this or assemble it or put it together things of that nature? But that's our problem solved. That's what keeps us in business. So don't slow down on these designs. did your approach to designing lenses change through this process? So through going through the jobs and finding out what you didn't like, it sounds like you started to shape kind of how you did like to work or how you did like to design. So can you comment on that at all?
Yes. Well, I found out pretty early that most people didn't think the way I did about optics. And I realized there was an opportunity in that by not being like somebody else, especially if people value that aspect of things. So early on, when I was working, I realized there didn't seem to be any way to learn how to do design benefiting from old-timers' experience. Nothing was written. There were no books that told you how to do design. And so I thought, well, but that's a very important thing. Methods and, you know, ways of systematically, and surely other fields are not like that. But in optics, it was the case. So out of necessity, I thought, well, then I'll come up with my own methods and I'll study what's a logical way to approach this process of design, which it was not seen written anywhere. Even today, there's almost nothing that tells you.
I was about to say this is a still a problem, but
lots about analyzing how you analyze something, but not how to do it. So I found that, and this is where the philosophy came in very handy, because philosophy can sort of help you refine how you think or teach you how to think and how to approach something. If somebody says, what's the meaning of life? How would you actually start thinking about that? So if you want to design a system, it became very clear to me that there's and this is a no-brainer kind of thing, that break the problem into separate parts that are ideally orthogonal so that you can solve this problem, this part, and then move to the next part in a way that won't undo what you just did. So that's, for example, why I always do a monochromatic design with no color correction first, because if you approach it the right way, it's possible later to do color correction in a way that doesn't disturb what you've just accomplished. And to me, that's just obvious, but I wasn't finding anybody saying those kind of things. So in the process of developing these methods, I also realized it was fun to tell people about it, to give talks, and I sort of became known as a person that does that kind of thing, that thinks about things and then shares it with other people. And that's helped my career enormously, because then I became well known,
right?
Which has certain benefits.
So there's an enormous amount to unpack in that short answer. I think first of all, you hit on the idea that, and I just want to highlight this just because it's a gripe for me, but also something that I would like to work on. But there's few resources on how you do a design. And the people that I know who are good at doing optical design, they've done it for a long time. That's their specialty, and that's how they've gotten good at it. Otherwise, the resources that exist are predominantly, as you're suggesting, how to analyze a design. And I think what this has caused is that a lot of people in optics, especially younger students of the field, tend to hammer away at the optimization button. They'll set as many variables as they can. In fact, let me do this. And I think that this will be a good process to kind of explore your design approach. As a younger optical designer, hopefully I've gotten a little bit better, but certainly as a younger optical designer, my approach was, here's a problem. And I know I'm a good optical designer because I will take a system that I know should be suited for it. Maybe it's a wide angle type of design requirement. I'm going to use a landscape lens or something like that. I'll start with that, So I'm already ahead of the game. I'm not just randomly doing things. And, you know, I have the optimization button. I'm going to set a bunch of surfaces and thicknesses variable. I might even add a few A spheres here and there, and then I just click optimize. And hopefully it converges. If it doesn't, maybe I'll take away a variable. But hopefully that won't be a problem. And that's how, as a younger student of the field, that's how I approach design. And I'm not very good at design still. So I don't know how much I've improved at it from that method. But what would you do different? Where did I kind of go wrong, so to speak, in that design process from your perspective?
Well, I wouldn't say you, yeah. Yeah, I would not say you did anything wrong. I would say, and I've said this on other occasions, I regard optical design as an intensely personal experience and process. People have different personalities, and you can't avoid expressing your personality during design, and why fight it? So my approach is I try to start things very simple conceptually, with taking some of what you said, knowing that, say, a wide angle, if it's a wide angle problem, you probably need a wide angle lens. But I never take something that exists and modify it. I always start with a blank piece of paper. And the main reason is it's more fun for me. I'm in this for myself. I'm in for this for my enjoyment of the process.
Right.
I know that if I want to get paid, it has to make somebody else happy. But that's not my motivation. So I enjoy the way I approach it, which is I try to start out as simple as possible with a first order configuration that meets the first order requirements, nothing to do with aberrations or anything, and make it as simple as possible. Then I add a bunch of aspherics to try to get good correction. And then I have a process for eliminating the aspherics one by one by adding lenses to make a more complicated system, and I slowly build up complexity. It's usually very hard to remove lenses once they're in a design. It's sort of like getting rid of the obnoxious person in some organization you're in. It's easy for them to join. It's very hard to get rid of them once they're there. So I try to not have to do that of simplifying an existing design. I'd rather build it up from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
But that's me. And I do what I'm good at. So it works well for me. But, there's equally valid other approaches.
Sure, absolutely. But I do think that, as you've suggested, your approach works well for you, and the designs that that have been produced by it, that I've seen anyways from some of your published work, are always very impressive. So I like that idea a lot more. And I think that it touches on your philosophy background. So why is it that you start a design saying, I'm coming in with no preconceptions about the appropriate predicate design landscape lens or what double Gauss, whatever the case may be. Instead, you come into it and say, I'm going to, on paper, solve the first order requirements. And certainly to some extent for pleasure, but does your philosophical background have any implications on that?
Yes, because when you build something up from a very simple starting point, there are many branch points, forks in the road that can evolve. So if you did the same thing, you, week later, you came back and did it all over again from scratch, you might end up with a different system. And the branching off into different directions is easy when things are simple. But in a complicated design, it gets frozen into just as our thinking gets frozen. And so it's much better, the most efficient use of your time, the most productive use of your time is in the beginning, not in beating the hell out of something in the end stages, even though the last bit may take most of the work, that final pushing. It's in that beginning stages where you may say, you know what, this is a better direction than what I was thinking a week ago. And your efficiency is much better because it takes very little time in the beginning stages to try a different idea, whereas it takes forever at the end, when you're trying to. So there's a lot of rationales that could support this approach.
Right.
Why do it this way?
Well, and one thing as you're talking that occurred to me is when you when I start a design from a prior design approach, and I say this will be a good fit, and I start optimizing, a lot of the changes happen and a lot of the surfaces exist, and I might not know why or how important they are. Is that meniscus lens really as important as I think it is? Is this aspheric surface necessary? And if you haven't really built all the way up to it, then like you're saying, you get to this phase where you're saying, well, I should change some stuff, but if I don't really know how important it is, it becomes a little tense adding or removing or changing things. So you have a bit more knowledge, I guess, about all the components of the design.
Well, also a lot of experience. I mean, I've been doing this for 57 years. And
right.
If I'm not good at it by now, I've wasted my time.
Well, and I'm even saying, just taking your design approach, if you go through the entire process, starting kind of at ground zero and working your way up, you know every surface in that design, and you know what it's doing.
You know why it's there. Exactly. You know why it's there.
Right.
Let me give one other quick example about this type of way of thinking. If you take the history of eyeglasses, which I've always found to be very interesting. When eyeglasses were invented in the 1300s, they consisted of somebody holding with their fingers some lenses in front of their eye to read or do some work. That didn't last very long because your arm gets tired.
Right.
So the next step was they had a stick where or a rod they could hold down here, goes up, and then the glasses are over like this in front of your face. The next step after that was a single lens, you know, a monocle.
Yeah.
And then after that was these things that rest on your nose with a little pressure. And usually with a little cord because they could fall off, you know. All those solutions were of a certain type, which is your face is in this plane, your eyes are here, and you're thinking the lenses ought to be here too. After all, your lens is going to be close to your eye. All solutions were thought of in that space. What we have today is somebody thought outside of the box. They say, wait a minute, there's another dimension here. Backwards,
right.
There's a depth. Now, what if you had started out with somebody says, here's this new invention, glasses, but we need some way to, you know, figure out how to hold them or something. If you spent your time in the beginning thinking, well, let's see, it could be, you know, maybe it would occur to somebody, consider that dimension at the very beginning. Because once you start to go down the path of what we did for hundreds of years, actually, it's hard to break away from that thinking. That's why,
right,
I always say, start in the beginning, questioning your assumptions and, you know, being more open to things at the very beginning.
When it's easier to change things up, you're not quite so ingrained in it, right? It almost touches on the sunk cost fallacy. But so that describes your design process, and I really like it. The first time that I saw this, the first time that I saw some of your slides, I was blown away by how funny your slides are or tend to be, and then how elegant the designs looked. Like, it just blew me away. It was like nothing I had ever seen for a lot of these designs. And it was touching on core principles and core concepts and optics, but nonetheless still achieving functioning designs that tended to be better than most things I'd ever seen. So can you talk about, and part of this is leading into, I've seen them online. So how would people, you know, benefit from your experience? Because you've shared a lot of your designs and approaches over the years online. So how do they find that?
I get very little feedback. And my impression is probably the people that actually are aware of my stuff regard it as a kind of entertainment. Somebody, a very experienced designer, once said to me, it doesn't matter if you give away all your secrets, nobody's going to do them because every person wants to do things their own way. And Dostoevsky once said, it's better to do things wrong your way than to do things right somebody else's way, because it's more personalized when you,
right,
you know, I mean, it doesn't make sense, but that's people. People are that way.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I've only found a few people who've gotten back to me and said they actually try these methods and that they work. But for the most part, people are going to go their own way.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think I first encountered your designs on SlideShare, and I'll share a link to that in this episode. But I think part of it felt like it wasn't what I was used to. Let me say that. So optics, in my opinion, my experience has been very academic. Most of the people that I know in it went through specific colleges just for optics. You know, kind of the books that you're supposed to go through and read, and you take the college courses, and to kind of stumble upon, here's an insane lens design just on a presentation slide somewhere randomly on the internet felt almost so alien. It took me a bit to be open to the idea of like, no, this is really good and really, and quite valid. And there's a lot to learn from that. So I think that might be one aspect. But you've also had plenty of publications themselves in journals, presentations, conference presentations. And I'll definitely link to some of those as well. So how did you, this is the constant problem of philosophy or an artist or anything else, but how did you take your passion for optical design and these very conceptual ideas and, for lack of a better phrase, survive and make money?
Yeah, again, that was somewhat of an accident. I was very fortunate that the third company I worked for, which is PerkinElmer, was just at the very beginning of the lithography business. And at that time, people weren't really, they had no idea what it would become. And today, ASML, the Dutch company, which sells lithographic equipment, they've vacuumed up most of the engineers in Europe. They're hiring today. They solve incredible, beyond comprehension technical problems. It's an immense business. Back then, when I was first getting into it, nobody could see that coming. But my approach and my ideas in some very early designs gave me a foothold in that business. And then at a certain point, I left PerkinElmer and became a consultant and started my own business in 1980. And I had visions of how this is going to be great. I'll have my own company. All the places I thought I might have as clients based on work I'd done when I worked for these companies, none of that panned out. I would have starved with the one exception of the company I just left, because I was involved in key design work for these early lithography projects. And I wasn't trying to hold them up or anything. I just thought, well, I don't have to have that because I have all these other things.
Right.
None of which materialized. But the day after I left the company, they hired me back as a consultant. It's despite a company policy that you can't do that kind of thing, because I just was in this key position. And that was so fortunate for me. And then lithography took off as a business. And I did many, many designs for Tropel and KLA and all kinds of places, Ultratech. And I just sort of stumbled into that, fortunately. And so, it's been great.
So this is I gave a talk to students at the U of A, 6 months ago or something like that, and had talked about doing a startup and a little bit of consulting to fund that startup. And I was blown away with how interested students were in consulting. So I wasn't necessarily expecting to cover this, but just to briefly ask you, how long did that take? How long did it take from you started your consulting business and PerkinElmer immediately said, oh no, we definitely need you. So that's good. You have a baseline, but how long did it take before other companies started to contact you or discover that you had a successful consulting business?
Very little, because at that time, there were only a few companies in that business and they weren't directly, they were competing in different aspects of the business.
Right.
So, that again was quite, fortunate. My main client, Zeiss, over the last 25 years, again, that was just an accidental hookup. I was doing work for KLA, which makes inspection, wafer inspection equipment. And I got a great design for them that they wanted to have built. So they went with me. They took me to Zeiss in Germany, who was going to build this stuff. And while I was there, Zeiss, they loved the design. They said, can you do design for us? I said, sure. So that started a big, long, but there's a lot of random events that happen in people's lives. And I just have been lucky in a lot of ways, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think you can plan on it.
Right.
Not a good thing to plan. And in a way, what I would say is I think it's a lot easier to get your foot in the door if people have heard of you. And the way to be heard of is to, these days, have a internet presence, like my slide share, mm-hmm. and go to conferences and that kind of stuff. Otherwise, who are you? You know.
So I'm curious. I'm strongly deviating from the plan. I hope it's okay with you. But sure. I'm really curious. You know, when I was a younger student, I felt very passionate or very strongly against the idea of networking. I thought, no, this is nonsense, and it's basically masking a lack of skill, you know, whatnot. I had very strong ideas. I can't think more opposite from that these days. I think networking is fantastic, not only because it's a pleasure to get to meet people in the field, such as yourself, but just as you're saying, that's how you get these connections.
One piece of advice, he said, your goal should be to work yourself out of a job with that particular client. In other words, solve the problem, meet their needs, and then leave instead of trying to squeeze out extra, you know, maybe not essential work for your needs. And he says, if you do that, they'll have an impression of you as somebody that's not out to bleed them dry as a consultant, but somebody that they a useful person to come to, and that will happen in the future. Now, I don't know if that actually works, but I just thought it was an interesting idea.
Right.
And my approach through my whole career has never been other people's needs. It's always been my needs. I'm in this for my own fun. And it has worked out for me, but it probably should not have. And
yeah.
More aware of what your client needs is probably good advice.
There's a one of my favorite bands, Wolfpack, almost at the beginning of every show that they do, they discuss there's a balance between the fact that we need to please the crowd, but also we really want to please us because we're the ones playing the music. And I think that kind of gets towards the idea. You know, we're kind of running a little bit low on time, but I guess there's a few things that I'd like to cover. So when you first started doing consulting, the landscape you've already described didn't look like today. It's fewer companies, things of that nature, but you also weren't doing design necessarily the same way we do it today. So what device and what tools were you using at the time?
When I first left to start my own company, there were no PCs. So I rented time on a mainframe using a modem, and the connection would often crash halfway through typing in some long design thing. But right soon after that, the first Apple PC came out, and a company that had a design program for the mainframes wrote a version for the PC. So I was able to start, you know, very early in my consulting business, having access to stuff. And again, mm-hmm. the timing was perfect. If I tried to do it earlier and was forced to have mainframe time sharing with a modem, I would have gone crazy because it kept crashing.
Right.
But one of the, this is a plug for the person that wrote that program was a designer. And I think there's a big difference between a design program written by a computer programmer versus one written by a designer who also does programming.
Mm-hmm.
And also, this is my general beef in the world about things. People that write programs should be forced to use them.
Yeah.
And that includes websites where you want to order something and you get down to the bottom where it turns out there's no send button or something. You know, there's, the people that write these things, they think, I don't know, that's a different beef. But anyway, so I'm a big fan of programs that incorporate into it the way a person might think or approach a design instead of just some random number crunching thought on the part of the person that wrote the program.
Right, right. Well, and it's coming from this this background, actually, it's all too easy to get caught up in the programming side of it, and then you finish and you try to use it, and you go like, "Oh, this is a nightmare. I can't at all do what I wanted to do with it." You're retired now. You're not about to retire. You are now retired.
As of 1 month, yes.
As of 1 month, and hopefully you're liking it so far. Yeah. Can you comment though on kind of looking back? I mean, you mentioned some of the designs that you've done, and it's astounding. So just to give context to listeners, if you don't want to, I'm happy to highlight this, but just some of your designs and where they've been used. I know that you talked a lot about it's for your enjoyment, and it's theoretical and conceptual stuff. But for listeners that aren't aware, these enjoyable concepts for you have had dramatic real world applications and have been built. So,
despite my best efforts, yes.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Well, the two highest profile designs are a unusual telescope that I invented in 1975, a long time ago, was built and went on space missions. So it was a combination of a telescope and a spectrometer. And the space mission, it was the Rosetta? No. I forget the name of it. It was one of the early ones. What they wanted was something that would be cheap to make, low risk, all reflective, a few other things. And this design was only spherical mirrors. It was unobscured, and it just turned out to be perfect for their needs. So they built this thing. One of them went to Saturn. Another one went to the asteroid Vesta. Another one went to the planetoid Ceres, and another one landed on a comet. So these things took a long time to get there, you know, but it was a very elegant, simple design that I basically thought of with no computing. I had to optimize it with a computer, but it was basically invented by pure thought. So it was very pleasant for me to have that be a success. And that's one of the things in my slideshow things. But the big one, from a financial point of view, is my lithography design for a high numerical aperture immersion system, which is used today to make all state-of-the-art computer chips by ASML, the company that makes these things. Every phone, TV, car, stereo, you name it, anything that's electronic has in it chips. And the ones being made for the last 15 years are all, no exceptions, made using this optical system that I invented. And it's made by Zeiss, and the optics require precision that's beyond imagination.
Mm-hmm.
The optical surfaces, which are highly aspheric, are accurate to a few atoms, ATOMS, atoms. That's beyond comprehension. How can you make something that's that accurate? The distortion budget of the imaging, geometrical distortion, is 1 nanometer. 1 nanometer, that's the budget. That's the budget. And they actually make it and deliver that kind of repeatable from unit to unit. Each one of these giant optical systems sells for about $30 to $50 million. And so far, Zeiss has made about $50 billion off of my design. $50 billion, and they continue to make them. The more recent state-of-the-art things are these ultra EUV systems, which use X-rays.
Mm-hmm.
I designed those kind of things too, and they're more expensive. And the company that makes it has a monopoly. There are no competing businesses. So they've got the world by the balls, you might
right,
say.
Right, right.
and so that's my design.
Yeah.
But again, I'm not so interested in it. I'm interested in the ideas that went into it.
Yeah.
That I'm proud of, but the success or not, I'm happy to have it, but it was not a factor in me enjoying working on it.
Right. And so there's two last things I'd like to discuss briefly. I know that we're kind of closing in on the amount of time that I asked. So, you know, if you have to get going, by all means, let me know. But one of them, I had emailed you that I read your paper on the perfect lens design, hiding in plain sight for 150 some odd years.
167 years. Yeah.
There we go. Yeah. Perfect. It's almost as if you know your paper better than I do. Can you describe this concept? Because it's an elegant way of kind of understanding a lot of optics ideas.
Yeah, it's the Maxwell fisheye lens, which every textbook, Born-Wolf, you know, other places, it's been known for 167 years, and that is a very elegant thing invented by Clerk Maxwell, with, I might add, no computer programs, and no ray tracing. I think there's a simple, very elegant mathematical proof that a ball with a grading index that's radially symmetric of a certain type does perfect imaging. If you have a point on one side of the ball, if the rays go across and come to a perfect point image on the other side, and inside the grading index ball, the rays are curved. They're not straight because of this grading index. Anyway, so that's been known forever. And if you look at any textbook that shows you a picture of it, they show, to indicate what's happening, they show a point on one side, the rays go over and they focus on the other side. Here's the assumption that's being made that nobody was thinking of. The assumption is when the rays come to a focus on the other side, they stop. The rays simply stop. Why should they stop? So I was looking at that picture and I thought, well, wait a minute. They're not going to stop. They're going to reflect off the inside of the ball, go all the way back again, reflect inside, and just go around forever.
Back and forth, right.
Yeah. So that was the first insight that I had of sort of thinking outside the box. People make an assumption, and pictures can be very confusing that way. It turns out every once in a while there's an advance in the art of perpetual motion machines. And the advance is nothing to do with them working. It's a new picture that's more misleading.
Right.
Because people say, oh, yeah, that would work, you know. So pictures can really, it's very hard to break away when you see a picture from thinking a certain way. Mm-hmm. So in this case, I realized the rays are going around forever. And then I realized that there was a very simple geometrical construction that shows that the whole inside of the ball is imaged perfectly on top of itself, but only because of that reflection, that interior reflection. And that simple geometrical construction, which has no math. And my paper was rejected by Applied Optics twice because it has no math in it. So that's the thinking, was that type of thing. And this whole construction was just through thinking about it, pure thought. Later, years later, after giving a talk about that, I said, well, wait a minute, I made an assumption too. I made an assumption in the original paper that you had to put a reflecting coating on the ball. But a couple of years ago, I said, wait a minute, you don't have to do that. You can sort of get a reduced version of the thing by just using its natural total internal reflection. You don't get the full angles that a coating will give you, but you get
a sufficient amount.
So that's the kind of thing.
Right, right. It's, you know, it's funny because the person who formally sparked my interest in getting into philosophy, she had a picture that it was just a picture, and it demonstrates Pythagorean's theorem. And she loved that thing. And it's really appealing now because it's kind of getting at that idea, like you're sharing, that you don't necessarily need the full mathematical proof to convey some of these concepts. But we'll be sure to share that that paper, and I might even actually overlay the photo of the design as drawn in your paper on this. So the one last part that I tend to like to do is to kind of do this little section that I absolutely stole from a different podcast called Overrated versus Underrated. And basically, I'll ask you a few topics, and I'm just curious to hear generally your thoughts on it and if you think it's overrated or underrated. Does that sound okay to you?
Yeah, I missed that.
Oh, sorry. Feel free to.
Yeah,
to,
Logan, what was the word you just said?
Sorry, I said overrated versus underrated. The first thing that I wanted to start with is, because you brought up this earlier, is the book The Brothers Karamazov. Have you read it?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Overrated or underrated?
Underrated.
Underrated. How come?
Well, it has a lot of philosophy in it that's sort of profound, and it's very well written. It's a good read.
Yeah, yeah. It's startling how well masks the philosophy is, almost, with how engaging it is. You know, the next question, in general, I would say studying philosophy, overrated or underrated? And I think I already know your answer, but maybe I'm wrong.
I would say it depends very much on what your goals are. It's not going to give answers to philosophical questions. There are no answers. In fact, the greatest philosopher of the 20th century, Ludwig Wittgenstein, he said, if you truly understand the questions, you won't ask them. Huh. You'll see that there's a lot of meaningless, empty concepts involved in these questions. Mm-hmm. If you really understood that, you'd say, you know, it's pointless to. And real quick, these people talk today about parallel universes. There cannot be parallel universes. And the reason is, by definition, a universe is everything. You can't have more than one everything, right?
Right. I like that a lot. It's I think there's a lot of philosophy books that I've read, and that was the first thing that stood out. Or one of the key takeaways I've had was how you approach discussing topics and how you approach it, basically coming to the conclusion that there aren't answers. You can endlessly debate things from any angle, but philosophy gives you a better framework to have some of those debates. So this might be a peculiar one, but going off of your work that had to deal with astronomy, and also your statement that, especially at a younger age, perhaps you liked working more in isolation, I'm curious what your thoughts are on the movie 2001: A Space Odyssey.
I saw that a very long time ago, and I don't remember it that well. But I really don't have a comment on that.
Okay, so it can't be too underrated if you don't remember it.
But here's a good space movie, underrated, Galaxy Quest.
Oh, it's one of my favorites.
I love that movie.
That's a fantastic film. I have about a million other questions I'd love to ask, but I don't want to take up too much of your time. Are there any, parting thoughts that you want to share, or anything that we didn't cover that you'd like to?
Just that I think it's an iffy, it's a quest that doesn't often work out, but instead of follow your bliss, I would say that it helps if your bliss is something that you can make a living at. So if you're lucky, you can do both, make a living and follow your bliss. But it's worth a try. And I think if it doesn't work, move on to something else. I mean, you have one life to live. And let's maximize it by, you know, not getting stuck in a rut over your plans and whatever. So that's maybe a point to consider.
I love it. My guest today has been Dave Schaefer. Dave, thanks so much for being part of this.
Well, it's been a lot of fun. And, thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Spotlight Report. As always, we invite you to go to our website, community.eleoptics.com, where you can communicate and discuss this episode of the podcast and find all other episodes of the podcast, as well as other useful information. Thanks. Have a great day.